Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The top eight Republican candidates for president took to the stage last night in Milwaukee. They debated the economy, immigration, and more. They stand alone at their podiums. Of course, there's a lot of money flowing through these campaigns and through the Democrats' campaigns, too. Small donors and very big ones, open listed contributions and dark secret ones. Direct contributions, super PACs being used, maybe abused in new ways. This hour on Point, we'll check in on the GOP debate and then follow the money in the 2016 campaign. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did you think of the debate, winners and losers? And what about the money? Joining me first today from Washington is Lisa Lehrer, national political reporter for the Associated Press, up late with a lot of others watching the GOP debate last night. Lisa Lehrer, welcome back to One Point. Great to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Let's listen in for just a second here. Donald Trump saying 11 million, have to go.
We have no choice. We have no choice.
Immigrants, the illegal immigrants, have to leave the country, says Trump. And here, and you heard it, of course, Lisa, John Kasich saying that can't be done. It's silly. It's not real.
Come on, folks. We all know you can't pick them up and ship them across back across the border. It's a silly argument. It's not an adult argument.
Lisa Lehrer, you were watching. So were a lot of others. Let's go to immigration right away. Do we have a real gulf here in the Republican field at this point?
Oh, there's certainly a divide in the Republican field over immigration. It's something we've been watching for years. And really what this is about is, of course, immigration policy. But beyond that, it is about the direction of the Republican Party. There's this fault line between sort of being strictly ideologically conservative and being more practical, either from a policy standpoint. Clearly, deporting 11 million people is going to be near impossible, according to experts. How do you even find these people? How do you round them up? It's going to cost a fortune in government resources to get all these people to deport them. But there's also some, you know, political concerns that many in the party establishment have, which is how does this kind of policy impact the Latino vote, which is a growing share of the country. So I think that's a real policy divide within the party, and it's one that exposes a larger conflict about where the Republican Party is going and where it should be going in the mind of its supporters.
Was Jeb Bush right last night when he said to Donald Trump, you know, as you talk about deporting all these people, Hillary Clinton's campaign is giving each other high fives? Is it that good for the Democrats?
Well, as someone who spends a lot of time covering Hillary Clinton's campaign, I can tell you that that is definitely true. They see the Latino vote as a key part of the electorate. Certainly, that was one of the constituencies that twice boosted President Obama to victory. It's a group that President Obama won by a huge margin, a historic margin. So if they could recreate that, the Hillary campaign, that would be very good for them. And, you know, Latinos are overrepresented in some states that often play pivotal roles in presidential races, like Colorado. So they see this kind of rhetoric from the party as on immigration, even if Donald Trump does not become the eventual nominee. They think it sets a tone for the race. It sets an image of the Republican Party that will be very beneficial for them.
Ted Cruz getting on board with the 11 million must go, or at least millions must go, last night. He and Marco Rubio are seen as sort of sitting right behind Donald Trump and Ben Carson, maybe as the maybe more mainstream, or at least politicians who might flow in there if those two don't go the distance. Is this a win the primary but lose the general thing for the GOP? Is it clear if you can be not as tough as Cruz and Trump on undocumented workers and still win the primary?
Well, that's sort of the premise that we're testing here, right? I think the way for your listeners to think about this primary is it's really two primaries, right? People are running in two lanes. There's a contest for who's going to be the pick of the establishment. You know, I call them the establishment, but maybe the more moderate section of the party, and who's going to be the pick of the more ideologically conservative wing of the party. And so you're going to eventually, hopefully, we don't know, because all the rules of conventional politics seem to not be applying this season, but theoretically, you'd have these two windows narrowed down to one candidate in each, and those guys will battle it out in a fight that could go on an awfully long time. But I think that part of the premise that Jeb Bush's candidacy is trying to test is whether you can win a primary with positions that are more palatable in a general, and I don't think we know the answer to that question yet, honestly.
Truth has been an issue here. Ben Carson under a lot of heat in recent weeks for his life story, elements of it. Last night, he defended himself sort of just very flatly, saying, you know, don't lie about me. Everybody should be vetted. Here he was.
We should vet all candidates. I have no problem with being vetted. What I do have a problem with is being lied about.
Lisa Lehrer, is Ben Carson stepping past the questions about his past?
Oh, I don't think he's stepping past them. I think he did so in this matchup, in this debate, but that's in part because of the moderation. I mean, the moderators of the previous debate at CNBC got a lot of blowback from the Republican Party, from the Republican candidates, so it seemed to me like the folks at Fox Business were playing it really safe, and they just didn't press Dr. Carson on anything. He sort of said, well, I believe the quote was, people who know me trust me, and they didn't question that. They didn't question any of his stories. They sort of threw him the question, let him give his answer, and moved on. So I don't think by any means this debate puts an end to the questions. I also thought it opened up some new questions about Dr. Carson, which were really about his command of policy. He seemed to be unable to answer questions about foreign policy, unable to give really coherent answers on questions on fiscal policy and breaking up the big banks. So we'll see if that does become a problem for him. Again, we're in a political cycle that's fairly unprecedented, where nobody seems to be able to predict the outcome. It doesn't seem like it's conforming to sort of the traditional rules of politics, where that kind of unfamiliarity with policy would hurt a candidate. But we'll have to see as people start tuning in more and more, and once we get past the holidays and really in the heat of this primary, whether his unfamiliarity with those issues comes back to hurt him.
We saw this gulf on immigration. What about on the economy? That was the putative subject of the debate last night, and there was a fair amount on it. Did you see sort of people in lockstep there, or did you see gaps, big gaps there as well, Lisa?
Well, there was one gap over bailing out the big banks and whether that's something that various candidates would have done. Kasich seemed to indicate that he would have done it. Ted Cruz certainly said that he wouldn't have.
Would let Bank of America go down.
Right. And that reflects, of course, this larger divide in the Republican Party between rigid conservatism and pure ideology and sort of more of a practical point of view, both politically and from a policy standpoint.
Did I see Kasich looking like he would raise the minimum wage? Certainly he talked about government intervening more, not just going pure market.
Yeah, he did seem to indicate that. I mean, Kasich was really trying to have a moment in this debate. He was interrupting a lot. He got a lot of speaking time. He was trying to very aggressively ingest himself in the conversation. But I think it is an open question whether his positions, things like bailing out the big banks, supporting a pathway to citizenship for immigrants already in the country illegally, his position on the minimum wage, as you pointed out, whether those are palatable positions in a Republican primary. And again, you know, that's something we'll have to see. I think one area where Kasich could be a factor is in New Hampshire, where it's possible he could pull some votes from Jeb Bush. So certainly people, I imagine the Bush team is watching very closely up there.
And then there was the issue of what it means to be a conservative. Came up last night between Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, two senators there, debating federal deficits and the cost of the U.S. military and what it means to be a conservative. Here's Senator Rubio first.
I know that Rand is a committed isolationist. I'm not. I believe the world is a stronger and a better place when the United States is the strongest military power in the world.
Marco, how is it conservative? How is it conservative to add $1 trillion expenditure for the federal government that you're not paying for? How is it conservative? How is it conservative to add $1 trillion in military expenditures?
Lisa, who's the conservative here? Cut the spending or spend to be the global power?
Right. Again, this is the debate the party's having, and it's sort of a proxy for an argument over how they win back the White House after 8 years of President Barack Obama. Do they win it back as sort of pure principled conservatism, or do they do it as sort of with a platform that's designed to broaden the Republicans' party's appeal to Latinos and other minorities? This is the same kind of issue.
I saw this as a different issue. Where do you spend the money? If you talk about cutting, can you spend trillions on military? I mean, Trump, too, was saying we got to get out of this military role, fix the roads, the bridges, the schools. And then Jeb Bush jumped in to try and school Trump.
Donald is wrong on this. He is absolutely wrong on this. We're not going to be the world's policeman, but we sure as heck better be the world's leader. There's a huge difference where without us leading, voids are filled. And the idea that it's a good idea for Putin to be in Syria, let ISIS take out Assad, and then Putin will take out ISIS. I mean, that's like a board game. That's like playing Monopoly or something. That's not how the real world works.
Kind of another version of the same argument there. This time Bush-Trump. Trump saying, let Putin go in and tromp around on ISIS. What about it? Who's got the vision that works now with the Republican voting population, Lisa?
Well, again, that's part of what this primary is testing, whether it is still the vision of Governor Bush's brother, President George W. Bush, which was, about the United States being involved in the world, being a leader in the world, and that means, of course, spending money, or this new crop of Tea Party conservatives who have a hold, particularly in the House, who want to cut government and cut spending across the board. So, it'll be interesting to see how this primary plays out, and that's going to give us a real sense of the direction that the party's voters want to go in.
What's your gut at this point, Lisa? Is it still the outsiders' year, Trump and Carson? Could one of them actually take it, or are they looking fragile up there at the top of the polls? How do you read it?
Well, look, Trump has remained stubbornly at the top of the polls, despite all predictions of his demise have been vastly overstated, it seems, so far. So, I mean, at this point, I don't really think we have any reason to believe that he will drop anytime soon. Does that mean that, we're still a good couple months out from the first round of voting? Does that mean he becomes the nominee? I mean, I'm not quite sure about that, but certainly he seems to have a pretty stubborn hold on the lead in all the polls, which has been surprising to a lot of people here in Washington.
Yeah, to say the very least, a very surprising season, and it still goes on. Another debate coming up in December in the midst of the holidays, a while before a lot of people may watch that again, but it has been quite the road show. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We have just been looking at the GOP debate last night, and we are moving right now to look beyond the debate stage, Republican and Democrat, to look at money and super PACs and more in the 2016 campaign. There is a lot flowing, and it is flowing in some new ways. You can join us this hour. Are you following the money in this campaign? With everything that's going on, what does it look like to you? Is it so decisive after all? Will it make Jeb Bush president? He's raised a lot. Do you see how super PACs are changing the way things work, how they're working differently this time? Is there still a bright line between the campaigns and the super PACs? All that money, unlimited money. It works in all kinds of ways, and not everybody even has a super PAC this time out. Bernie Sanders, foremost among them. You've seen him debating Hillary and a whole lot more, drawing big rallies. Here he was in Boston just last month, talking with a big crowd about his campaign's relationship with super PACs.
I don't have a super PAC. I don't want a super PAC. And I don't need a super PAC. We have something that they don't have. Look around this room. This is what we have.
All right. Bernie Sanders doesn't have one, doesn't want one. No super PAC, please. He's got all those people, but they are out there. They are raising a lot of money, and they are at work. Lots of ads out there already. Earlier this month, a super PAC supporting Ted Cruz called Courageous Conservatives attacked Marco Rubio and used the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School to make a political point. This is a little bit of that video.
Marco Rubio looks good on TV, but that's about it. Ted Cruz for president. Ted Cruz walks tall for what we believe. Standing up, often standing alone. Ted Cruz makes things happen. After Sandy Hook, Ted Cruz stopped Obama's push for new gun control laws.
a super PAC at work right there for Ted Cruz. With us right now from Washington, Matea Gold, national political reporter for The Washington Post, covers money and influence. Matea, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
And from the Center for Responsive Politics, investigator Robert McGuire is with us. He looks at political nonprofits, helps run OpenSecrets.org. It's a nonpartisan money and politics news site, tracks campaign contributions and lobbying. Robert McGuire, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Okay, Matea, I want to look at the numbers with you, but first, just if we step back for a second, here's a headline from just a couple of months ago in Politico. It says, turns out billionaires can't buy the White House. This is after Scott Walker and Rick Perry dropped out of the race. And that is one of the memes out there right now, Matea, is that money can't buy love after all. Jeb Bush raised maybe more than anybody, and he's not at the top of the polls. What about the basic notion that money buys power this time?
I think it is really too soon to say what impact some of these big money super PACs and other politically active groups are going to have on the ultimate outcome of the race. But I think what is absolutely clear is that the proliferation of these groups has really dramatically changed the landscape of the 2016 election. We saw candidates embrace super PACs aligned with their campaigns closer than any previous presidential candidates, and really almost across the board. I mean, you mentioned Bernie Sanders not having a super PAC. He's practically the only one. On the Republican side, Donald Trump was claiming he didn't have a super PAC, and the Post reported last month that, in fact, there was a super PAC with close ties to his campaign that has since been shut down. But what we've really seen happen is a closer collaboration between the presidential candidates and these well-funded outside groups than any previous cycle.
Robert, I thought that was out of bounds. I thought that was illegal.
It is. It's just remarkably easy to get around the rules that define coordination. I mean, you can share offices, you can share employees before you become a candidate. You can go and strategize with the groups that are going to be supporting you once you declare your candidacy. I mean, we saw last spring these candidates waiting and waiting and waiting to declare because they were setting up sort of their network of organizations. And what's notable about that is it's not just super PACs this time. It's these single candidate 501c4s that they're also are operating with. You know, when I first turned on my TV last night, before the debates, the first ad I saw was run by Conservative Solutions Project, which is a 501c4 supporting Marco Rubio. It has run all of his ads up to this point. And it's not supposed to be a political organization. So not only is it not supposed to coordinate with them, but a 501c4 is not supposed to be a political entity supporting a candidate for office.
Matea, can we just back up and look at the basics for a second? There's so much flowing here, and as you say, flowing in dramatic new ways with all kinds of new coordination. I mean, the first sort of bucket is the campaigns themselves. This is old school, old fashioned. You can contribute. But that is different because it's all public. I mean, it's all listed who gives what, and there's a limit, right, Matea, for what you can give to the campaign.
Right. The clearest demarcation between the candidates' own committees and these super PACs is the amount of money that can be given and, to some extent, who can give the money. So only individuals can give direct contributions to candidates, and the maximum they can give for the primary is $2,700. Super PACs, on the other hand, can take unlimited sums from both individuals and corporations. They do have to disclose their donors, but they're actually on a very limited disclosure schedule this year. The next time we're going to find out about the amount of money and who's giving the money to super PACs is in January. So we're really in sort of a dark period for the rest of this year as a lot of these groups, as Robert said, are already out there raising money.
And then it gets even darker with the 501c4. Do they have to list who's giving the money at all?
No. So these are politically active nonprofit groups set up under a section of the tax code that was really aimed for social welfare organizations. A lot of politically oriented groups have taken advantage of sort of the looseness of the definition of 501c4s. They do not have to disclose their donors, and they're on very delayed reporting schedules about their spending as long as they don't do explicit political ads. And so they have a lot of leeway to get involved in campaigns. They can actually do explicitly political ads as long as that's not their primary purpose, and they don't have to tell anyone who's funding them.
So, yes, Robert.
So, you know, what's interesting about this, too, is that essentially the lesson of politically active nonprofits is if you have the right Washington lawyers, you can get money into the system any way you need to get money. And if you don't want your name attached, they will set up a nonprofit, and they will think of everything for you. And a great example of that, again, is Conservative Solutions Project, which filed an annual tax return for $63 recently. And the tax return only covered their first 6 months of operation. And the main reason they did that was to set a fiscal year for the organization such that the spending that is happening now, so not even, mm-hmm. we're not even in the election year yet. The spending that is happening right now, the millions of dollars they're dropping on ads, will not be reported to the IRS until 2017, spring of 2017.
When it's all over.
Right. You know, Rubio could already be inaugurated by the time the IRS knows what this group is actually doing.
So let me just ask you, you said this group, Conservative Solutions Project, is paying for his ads. You saw one, I guess, just last night. So who is it? What does that mean? Who's paying for Rubio's ads? Who's the money? It comes out of somebody or some company's pocket. Who?
Well, we don't know who's paying for the money.
That's a fantastic question. What's going on with that?
Well, I mean, I think there are some clues as to who the group's leaders are. It shares a very similar name to a super PAC that is supporting Rubio, and it shares a lot of the leaders to that group. And so they have said that the C4 is not just set up to support Rubio, because that would be actually a violation of tax law. But so far, we've seen them put a lot of money, as Robert said, into ads touting Senator Rubio's record.
I mean, Robert, I ask it just that way because when Marco Rubio or Hillary Clinton or whoever's standing there and they're talking about policy, you kind of want to know if there's a money hand in the puppet that's directing that. And if you know who's contributing, you can at least think about what their agenda might be and what they might want from that candidate. So when we look at Marco Rubio and you've got all this dark money, black money, a 501c4, it seems quite pertinent who's giving that money. So do we know?
Precisely. I mean, this is the reason we have disclosure laws.
But we don't on these until 2017 when, you know.
Right, right. Well, so even then, it won't be disclosed. What I mean is since Watergate, we've had, you know, decades of disclosure laws so that we know what might be influencing the decisions of people in elected office. You know, whether or not they win or lose, they still maintain these ties to the people that are funding these outfits. But now, not only do we not have disclosure for an increasingly large piece of the pie, we also don't know if it's, you know, a lot of it is assumed to be individuals, but let's not forget that, you know, in the case of Hillary Clinton, it could be a union. Mm-hmm. If she ever establishes one of these groups, it could be union funded. Or, you know, in any of the other groups, it could be corporate.
I mean, she has a super PAC that's behind her. Does she have a 501c4 that's in her orbit or not at this point?
There are nonprofit advocacy groups that are supporting her that are very well known, like Emily's List. She doesn't have anything similar right now that is sort of a pop-up nonprofit group. One of the super PACs affiliated with her Priorities USA Action had a nonprofit arm when it was supporting President Obama, but that's since been shuttered.
But, I mean, does she have one of these dark money, black money 501c4s that's backing her up?
Not at this point.
Not operating in the same way that a group like Conservative Solution Projects or American Next, and that, you know, they're not funding trips around the country for town halls or buying lots of ads in support of Hillary Clinton. I mean, she has, for example, behind her, there's the American Bridge, which has a super PAC and a C4. It operates essentially as an opposition research firm. It is essentially serving as an outlet for fodder for Democratic ads. So anything that looks negative for a Republican, you know, they can come to American Bridge and they can get that information. But it's not.
And that is a 501c4.
There is a 501c4 and an American.
So that is a dark money outfit that is affiliated or in the orbit of Clinton and maybe other Democrats.
Yes, but it's not one of these pop-up groups. It's not, you know, it's been around.
Yep.
It's done this for in races around the country, which is it's certainly that's not to say it's not relevant. This is the nature of American elections right now. These groups are operating in a lot of different ways in elections, influencing the elections under the guise of being a social welfare organization or a trade association. And there's very little oversight from the IRS or the FEC on this.
Mateo, step back for a second. I want to get into individual backers of individual candidates when it comes to the big, big, you know, seven-figure and plus realm. But what about overall, when you look at the Democratic contenders, when you look at the Republicans, who's relying more on the contributions to their campaigns, limited to $2,700 in the primary, and who's relying more on super PACs, unlimited individual and corporate contributions, Mateo?
Well, it's really interesting. Both the parties have actually pursued very different strategies in terms of where they're putting the emphasis on fundraising, and in some ways out of necessity. So far, about $500 million has been raised to support the presidential candidates this cycle, either through their own campaigns or their outside allies. On the Democratic side, that total is about $140 million. Just 12% of that money is for super PACs and their outside groups. On the Republican side, it's about $379 million, and 62% of that money has gone to outside groups. Now, there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that Republican donors have shown a greater willingness to embrace some of these vehicles early on. We first saw super PACs come on the scene in the 2010 cycle in the wake of the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, and we saw conservative donors really rush to fill the coffers of these groups. Democratic donors have been more reluctant, have expressed some distaste for the role these organizations are playing, but this year they're definitely stepping up in a bigger way than ever before. Still, we're seeing Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders raise substantially more resources directly into their campaigns, and largely, particularly with Bernie Sanders' case, through small donors who are giving $5, $10, $25 over and over again.
Robert, I guess the source can be seen to matter here. If you're only raising 12% from super PACs, outside groups, that means you're raising overwhelming the bulk of it for your campaign, where you've got a cap of $2,700. That means smaller donors. If you've got 62% from super PACs, outside groups, those can be, presumably most are, much larger donors. And you've got people shoving in millions here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's already three donors so far who've given more than $10 million or more this cycle. And that's in terms of disclosed contributions.
To whom? So, to whom?
Well, the largest ones are going to a super PAC called Keep the Promise. That's Robert Mercer, Stacey Wilkes, and Toby, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Neuberger, I believe is his name.
Okay.
Yes.
To whom?
So Keep the Promise is a super PAC supporting, actually it escapes me right now, is it
Ted
Rubio?
Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
But just to put this in context in terms of fundraising, but Jeb Bush's super PAC, Right to Rise, raised $103 million as of the first 6 months of this cycle. That's four times more than all 52 super PACs combined in the 2012 cycle at the same point.
Wow.
On the spending side, we had, at this point in 2012, we had $5.2 million spent by super PACs. We now have $69 million having already been spent by super PACs. And nine of the 10 top spending super PACs are super PACs that were established to support a particular candidate. And again, that's not even including, for example, the Conservative Solution Project spending, which is about $8 million at this point.
The real dark stuff. Mm-hmm.
Right, because they're claiming the ads are educational. They're issue ads. So they're not even reporting them to the FEC.
So in the volume, way bigger than last time out, and we thought it was huge last time, in the way they're used, much more coordinated, which puts them much more right in the cockpit. And yet, Mateo, we see Jeb Bush, he's lagging. So does that mean that in spite of the scale, this is not what tips the scale?
Well, I think one of the fascinating developments in this cycle is that money has not turned out to be the determinative factor that a lot of folks anticipated it would be. In past elections, we've really seen money as a direct correlation of someone's political strength, and that's largely because people had to raise their money in small increments from lots of supporters. Because we have now seen the ability of billionaires to infuse these groups with vast amount of resources. It has given some of these candidates, I think, a misplaced sense of their own standing in the field. We already saw this happen with former Texas Governor Rick Perry and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who had huge amounts, tens of millions of dollars in super PAC supporting them, but their own campaigns actually ran out of money and they had to drop out of the race. Jeb Bush was seen to be, you know, the clear front runner heading into this cycle because of how much money he raised, and he's clearly languishing in the polls right now.
Really interesting scale and application and outcome on the money front here. We're going to come back and take calls from our listeners. We're going to hear from Lawrence Lessig, who campaigned against this as a candidate until he dropped out recently, but he's still fighting on this front. Matea Gold at The Washington Post. Please stand by. Robert McGuire at the Center for Responsive Politics. Are you following the money? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about money and super PACs in the 2016 campaign with Matea Gold of The Washington Post, Robert McGuire of the Center for Responsive Politics. Lawrence Lessig joins us in just a moment. Yes, there are super PACs behind others as well. Here's one behind Hillary Clinton. Priorities USA Action was defending Hillary Clinton last month ahead of her testimony on Benghazi before the House. They used Congressman Kevin McCarthy's statement about the Benghazi Special Committee.
Republicans are playing politics over Benghazi.
Everybody thought Hillary Clinton was unbeatable, right? But we put together a Benghazi special committee, a select committee. What are her numbers today?
Republicans can play political games, but Hillary Clinton will always stand strong for us. Priorities USA Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Super PAC right there behind Hillary Clinton, and of course all kinds of money behind Republican candidates as well. Lots of comment feedback here online. John says he wants a constitutional amendment defining the giving of any money directly or indirectly to political candidates as bribery. Daphne says no money, 5-week campaigns. Good luck with that. Matea, I mean, yeah, it's a great idea, but it's not where we are right now. Matea, Robert, stand by. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you for calling, Carl. You're on the air.
No problem. You know, it's appropriate that it's called 501c4.
Why?
Because it is really blowing up our Democratic Republic. It really is. And, you know, you hear Republicans with their fake outrage towards the media. But this time, the media does need to take a little blame because they're the one that's profiting from that $69 million that's being spent this cycle over the $5 million because they're the people that's making the money off the commercials that's being put on their stations. And they need to call themselves out for this. And you don't hear enough from the media banging the drum, but they won't because it's like cutting their nose off spite their face.
Well, that's true in many ways. Carl, I'm glad you raised that point. It's more than $69 million there. I mean, before this is all over, thank you, Carl. Matea, what are we likely to see spent on media in total in this campaign cycle?
Oh, definitely billions, and the estimate is all over the place. I mean, I will just say I've covered this beat for 5 years now, and I actually think that there's more coverage in the media of these issues than I've ever seen in any previous election. And it's having an impact. You can see in public polling, you actually see pluralities, if not majorities, of Americans who are voicing real serious concern about this issue now. And I do think that's a direct correlation to the fact that they're hearing more about it and reading more about it.
But it's one thing to hear and read about it. It's another, Robert McGuire, to really go after it. I mean, does a few billion in an election cycle buy a kind of compliance from the media when it comes to all the money running here?
Well, I think the point of profit is an important one. You know, television stations are thrilled at the system, and this is going to raise their bottom line quite a bit. But it's not just the television stations; it's consultants, it's media firms, and you know what we're seeing. For example, just yesterday, the FEC ruling on a 501c4, they basically said, you know, it's too late for us to do anything now because it's been 5 years in the making. And a part of that was people skimming, you know, I think it was $1.1 million off the top of this organization and just counting that as a fundraising fee. you know, and nothing's going to happen with that. This is happening in a lot of different instances where people are lining their pockets with a lot of this money. And it's the legitimate sort of television station money, but there's a lot of consultants around the D.C. area that are also, you know, buying nice houses because they're running these groups for people.
And yet, as Mateo says, it's a hot potato, too, and as we see in the Jeb Bush campaign, it doesn't necessarily buy you love. Scott in Alpine, Texas. Scott, you're on.
Hey, it's amazing to me to listen to this whole discussion, and it has turned since I called, but it's again almost like listening to the MSNBC Republican debate and how well you guys discuss the taint of this when you are discussing the Republican candidates. And you throw in, Hillary Clinton, but she is a master of accumulating money. The Clinton Foundation is dubious in the way that it's accumulated money. And if you don't think that is a political-driven thing, you are smoking crack.
Hey, Scott, I appreciate your call. You know, we've done a whole hour on the Clinton Foundation, but when you look at these numbers, Scott, I mean, it is interesting that you've got 12% of the Democrats' money coming from super PACs and 62% of the Republicans. I mean, just straight on the facts, that looks like a pretty interesting difference, does it not?
It does, although the numbers are very skewed.
Why? What do you mean?
Because you've got Bernie Sanders, who is running on exactly, I'm just running a campaign and not a super PAC campaign.
Yeah, but that's not skewed. That's a fact.
And
I mean,
then you have... And then you have so many more candidates that are sitting on the Republican side.
Well, that's true. You've got a lot more candidates on that side. Of course, they could all be denying, saying no to super PACs like Bernie, or they could be relying more heavily on limited campaign donations like Hillary. But I take your point, and I'm glad for your call, Scott. Thank you very much for that. I want to bring
Tom.
Yes, Mateo,
Tom,
please.
Can I just speak to that briefly? I think the caller makes a good point, and one thing important to note is that while Hillary Clinton has raised huge amounts for her campaign, and she's promised to make campaign finance reform a major plank of her administration, she also is taking advantage of all of these rules. I mean, she actually is coordinating directly with a super PAC through her campaign through a loophole in FEC law, and her campaign has set up a jumbo joint fundraising committee with state parties that is raising huge sums from individual donors. She's the first 2016 candidate to take advantage of that.
So there's a blurred line here as well. That jumbo joint fundraising, is that limited or is that super PAC unlimited?
So that is something that was the manifestation of another Supreme Court decision called the McCutcheon case that basically said people cannot be limited in the number of candidates and campaign committees and PACs that they give to.
Right.
And one of the outcomes of that is that we're seeing candidates and party committees set up these massive joint fundraising committees so they can ask an individual donor to write one big check that's then apportioned theoretically to all these different committees.
Okay.
But because of that, Hillary Clinton is able to ask individual donors for $366,000 in 1 year. So, I mean, she definitely is taking advantage of the new leeway in this landscape.
Working it from all kinds of angles. Every time we turn around, there's another little money door opens up. Maybe not so little. Mateo Gold, Robert McGuire, stand by. Lawrence Lessig joins us right now, professor at Harvard Law School, advocate for campaign finance reform, and until just about a week ago, a candidate himself for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. Couldn't raise enough money to keep that going, but he's talked a lot about the corrosive impact of money in American politics. Lawrence Lessig, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Thanks, Tom. Let me just make one point clear, though. We'd actually raised more than money than almost half the race in the Democratic side, more than five of the Republican candidates, but the thing that blocked us from being able to continue the campaign is that we were not able to get into debates because the rules were shifting in the debate. So, you know.
Fair enough. Sorry if I misstated there. How do you see what's happening this time on the money front in campaigns? You've campaigned and talked about this and thought about this for years. What's the evolution in the 2016 campaign season?
Well, I think this campaign cycle is showing exactly the core problem with the system we've allowed to evolve, and that is not so much the spending. People are, you know, obsessed with whether the money's having an effect or whether the money's actually persuading voters. I don't think that's the problem. The problem is the fundraising. The problem is that we rely on an increasingly small number of people to be the core funders of campaigns. So, you know, 158 families giving half the money to the super PACs and the candidates directly means that we have concentrated even greater the influence of this tiny, tiny number. And Matteo's point about these super fundraising committees will even further that concentration. And this is the core problem with our democracy. We have outsourced the funding of the campaigns to a tiny, unrepresentative slice of America, and we see the candidates bending over backwards to make that tiny, unrepresentative slice happy while creating an ever greater gap with the views of the ordinary voters.
Give us some specific examples, if you're willing,
sure.
Lawrence, about what candidate kneeling on what cushion.
Yeah, so the greatest example was actually came from an article by Paul Krugman about a month ago, where he was talking about the fact that the Republican candidates were proposing changes to Social Security, which the Republican base did not support. And his question was, why would the Republican candidates be advancing a Social Security plan, privatizing Social Security, that the Republican base does not support? And the answer is, the funders of their campaigns support it. So here, a pretty fundamental issue central to the decisions that everybody's going to be making this election cycle was being directly guided not by the views of the voters, but the views of the essential step to getting to the voters, the funders. And I think, you know, we can, when you begin to look at the wide range of issues, we can see the way the government is incredibly sensitive to the views of these funders, but not sensitive to the views of their average voters.
Matteo Gold, can we look into that black box? Can you cite some litmus test laid down by a particular billionaire that a particular candidate has agreed to in order to win the golden contribution?
I don't think it's as clear-cut as that, but you can obviously see the influence that those who have access to these candidates have just by the fact that they, in the primary case, take up a lot of their time. I mean, earlier this year, we saw the candidates spending enormous amounts of time, instead of going to Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, actually traveling to resorts all over the country to meet with very well-heeled donors. The Koch Political Network, which is a very powerful kind of organization of conservative donors, has been particularly influential on the Republican Party. One of the big issues they've been touting is the XM Bank and trying to stop that from being reauthorized, and that's an issue we've seen candidates
they failed.
Take up on the trail.
It's not been cut off at this point.
Right, but you could see the influence mm-hmm. of that conversation just
yeah.
In the way that candidates were talking
do.
About it.
Yeah. Matt in Austin, Texas. Matt, you're on the air with Lawrence Lessig, Matteo Gold, Robert McGuire.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What do you see?
So I'm calling in just kind of as a bit of an outsider to a lot of this conversation, but I wanted to say that just as a standard American, middle-class American, it's completely disheartening to see the complete lack of control that someone like myself would be able to have over this conversation. It's not just go and cast your vote. That's no longer how this works.
You could give $2,700 if you had enough money, Matt.
That's absolutely true, and I actually am looking to get as much of that amount as I can into the Bernie Sanders campaign for a lot of the same reasons that some of these other folks are calling in about, that we need to move away from the inundation of money into the election process.
We hear it, and I know a lot of people feel the same way, and yet a lot still comes in, but I appreciate your call, Matt. One more right here, Brookfield, Connecticut. Mike, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just calling because I'm a young parent,
okay.
And I'm just very tired of the way our political system really has been up to the highest bidder for so long. And I'm curious if a candidate like Bernie Sanders, who's actually the first presidential candidate that I've ever donated to, I'm curious if someone like him who refuses to take money from super PACs actually stands any chance of winning an election.
Let us pick it up. Matteo, can Bernie go up against the Clinton money machine and win with his posture toward money?
I actually think the challenge for Sanders is less about financial resources because he's been so effective tapping into a strong online donor base, and it's more just sort of the mechanics, the political mechanics of the race, and you know his own position in the field. So I actually think, you know, there's not sort of a zero-sum game here where if you have a super PAC, no one can defeat you. I mean, there's clearly the ability, and President Obama showed this, that small donors can raise tens of millions of dollars together.
Lawrence Lessig, what do we learn from the Jeb Bush story here? Raised far and away the most for a long time, still the most by a long shot, and he is flagging in the polls. Does that mean maybe it's not so important after all, or not?
Well, it might not be important to the voters, but again, I think it's incredibly important to the candidates as the candidates adjust their views in order to raise the money. But I think the really important question that, you know, the last two comments from the callers have highlighted is, what's the solution? How do we go forward here, right? And what's really incredible to me about this race so far is that we have not seen any of the candidates really surface in their conversation, not in the debate, Democratic debate so far at least, changes that would actually make this system work differently.
You were going to try. You were on that path.
Yeah. While it's not happening at the federal level, it's happening at the state level. You know, Seattle just passed a public funding proposal to give vouchers to every Seattle voter to help fund campaigns from a bottom-up perspective. Maine just passed a referendum to reinforce this public funding system that exists in Maine and has existed in Maine for almost 20 years that makes it possible for candidates to raise money from small-dollar contributions and not have to depend on the big contributors. What we need at the federal level is candidates talking about the need to change the way campaigns are funded. And we could do that tomorrow without any change in Supreme Court doctrine. And if we did that, then the significance of these tiny few funders would change dramatically. And that's the kind of change that we got to see these candidates talking about.
How would it be done tomorrow without a Supreme Court change?
Because the Supreme Court has again and again said that you can have public funding of public elections. And the kind of public funding that Seattle has just adopted, these sort of bottom-up voucher proposals, or the matching fund proposals that John Sarbanes has put forward, and you've had him on your show, the Government by the People Act, these are all perfectly constitutional under the existing Supreme Court doctrine. It doesn't deal with the super PAC problem. And I actually think the Supreme Court's going to fix the super PAC problem independently of any of this kind of political action. But put that to one side, the core problem is still we rely on a tiny, tiny few to fund campaigns, and we could change that tomorrow if politicians would only begin to talk about it.
We are going to keep following the money in this campaign. Lawrence Lessig took a stab at doing it right there in the midst of the campaign. Didn't work out, but what a campaigner he's been. Lawrence Lessig, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Matea Gold at The Washington Post, it's always great having you. Let's talk again, Matea. Thanks for joining us.
Would love that. Thanks, Tom.
And Robert McGuire at the Center for Responsive Politics and OpenSecrets.org. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.